Welcome to Creature Feature, a production of iHeartRadio, the show where we get a big bowl of animal brains, a cup of human brains, blend them together, bake them at 425 degrees for half an hour, and voila! I'm your host of Mini Parasites, Katie Golden. I studied psychology and evolutionary biology, and I ate raw snails when I was a toddler. This is true. Today on the show, we're talking weird diets. Animals eating other animals eating other animals. Humans eating, well, some pretty freaky things. Discover this and more as we answer the age-old question, is cannibalism good for you? Diets across the animal kingdom can be fascinating, and who better to speak to this than Charles Darwin, father of evolutionary theory, who decided during the long, arduous trip aboard the Beagle that moldy bread just wouldn't cut it. So he sampled some of his animal specimens. Darwin had actually been a member of the Glutton Club at Cambridge University before making his famous discoveries. So perhaps it's less surprising that he used his adventures as an excuse to eat giant tortoises, iguanas, armadillos, puma, and agouti, which is a giant squirrel-like rodent. And he even accidentally ate part of a lesser rhea, a bird he'd been trying to collect a scientific specimen of for several months. So what better way to celebrate evolutionary biology than to take a gustatory trip through the animal and human world? Joining me today is Catherine Spires, food writer and host of the podcast Smart Mouth.
Hi.
Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you. I'm excited to talk about this stuff.
Yeah. So your podcast explores culinary things.
We do a lot of food history. I have
a guest on
and I ask them ahead of time, what's your favorite food or whatever? And
then
I research the heck out of it and I'm like, did you know?
Well, I'm glad that you are into food because this is going to be a pretty, it'll be a wild ride.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
I wanted to start out, I got a listener question that I think really is very suitable for this topic.
Uh-huh.
Amy B. asks, a creature I like a lotl is the axolotl. Nice one, Amy. And I was wondering what strange incidents and or weird and wacky facts are associated with these little cuties. So, there's a wacky fact that I know about axolotls,
uh-huh.
which is that they will only grow up into adults when they eat each other.
Oh, so not a lot of them grow up into adults?
No, they don't actually. So axolotls, little background, they're a critically endangered species of salamander. They're related to tiger salamanders. They live in Mexico. They're also known as the Mexican walking fish. They're not a fish. They're an amphibian. They have four underdeveloped limbs and lidless eyes.
Oh, boy.
I'm already painting a nice picture of
yeah.
these guys. They also have those like fluffy, feathery sideburns.
Mm-hmm.
Those are actually external gill stalks, and that's how they breathe underwater.
Oh, my gosh.
So they can even regenerate their body parts, even parts of their brains.
Whoa.
Yeah, so they're pretty cool already. And their method of eating is like Kirby-style vacuuming in food.
Okay.
The reason only some of them grow to adulthood mm-hmm. is that they're neotenic, meaning that they reach sexual maturity in their juvenile aquatic form. So they never actually undergo metamorphosis to their adult terrestrial form in most cases.
Oh, wow. So is this a rare occasion where the fact that they're almost extinct is their fault? They eat each other?
No.
Oh, okay.
They it's actually because of the urban sprawl of Mexico City that's threatening their environment.
Do they eat other things besides each
yes,
other?
Yes. Okay. So they eat like insects, worms, small fish. They're carnivores.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time they don't actually become cannibals, but if they do, they will actually, that will trigger their metamorphosis into adulthood.
Wow.
So the biological reason axolotls don't go through metamorphosis is that they lack thyroid-stimulating hormone. Remaining in that juvenile form is actually a survival mechanism in environments that lack adequate nutrition for their larger adult form.
Okay.
And especially things like iodine, which they need in their diet and they can't necessarily get enough of. But if they start to get enough nutrition, like enough iodine, which they get by eating other axolotls, this will actually trigger their body to start metamorphosis. So if they cannibalize enough other axolotls, they will turn into larger terrestrial adults. You can even artificially induce this by giving them iodine or thyroid-stimulating hormone injections.
And it like makes them crazy for more?
No, they'll just like that'll give them a thirst for blood.
Right.
No, they'll transform into a terrestrial one. And actually a lot of people keep axolotls as pets. And I saw these axolotl owner forums where they're like, oh, what to do if your axolotl like metamorphosizes into an adult.
Oh my gosh.
Because you can't keep it in a fish tank anymore because they will need to breathe air. Like that they'll grow lungs and it like a frog, you know,
yeah.
That goes from tadpole, which is fully aquatic, to being terrestrial, and then it can't breathe underwater anymore.
Is it an okay idea to keep one of them as a pet?
Yeah, I mean, it's okay. I think that if they're bred, you know, I don't know too much about like the ecological impacts of owning them as pets. If they're bred in captivity, I think that's probably okay. But like, obviously the pet trade could present a problem.
Right.
I think the bigger problem for them is just the urban sprawl and the sort of human impact on their environment. But I don't think, as far as like exotic pets go, I don't think it's too much of a problem. As long as you don't, you know, there are a lot of rules for having exotic pets. You don't want to like introduce them to wherever you live. You know, you don't want to like dump them off in a lake or anything like that, or flush them down the toilet because you can really screw up with the ecosystems in your own area when you introduce species that are not from there. So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think it's mostly okay as long as they're not being gotten from the illegal pet trade.
Right, as long as.
So speaking of creepy aquatic animals, Greenland sharks will eat entire polar bears.
Wow.
I didn't really think there was anything that would eat polar bear, but Greenland sharks are huge. So they live near, Greenland and Iceland. They grow up to 25 feet long and they can weigh over 2,000 pounds.
That's too many pounds.
That's a few too many. And it's a species of sleeper shark. These are sharks that live at great depths, and they move really slowly and sluggishly.
Mm-hmm.
They're freaky in that they just seem ancient, like these ancient callbacks to dinosaur times.
Can I tell you the animal I'm most afraid of?
Sure, go for it.
Whales.
Really? You wouldn't like this.
No.
It's kind of like it looks like a whale mixed with a shark.
Yeah, that's terrifying to me.
And it's deep, deep underwater.
Right.
Why are you afraid of whales? Just because of how big they are?
Yeah, they're too big.
Yeah, I think that's like part of the thalassophobia thing, where it's like you're afraid of like big things in the depths of the ocean.
That's interesting. I mean, I definitely curl my toes a lot when I'm swimming so that the monsters won't get them.
Greenland sharks actually literally are ancient because they have a lifespan of up to 500 years.
Holy cow.
Yeah. And specimens that are sometimes cut. And it's hard to actually encounter like specimens, especially like live specimens, because of the depths at which they live. When they actually date the bodies of these Greenland sharks, like they live hundreds of years old.
That's crazy. I'd never even heard of these.
Yeah. It is interesting. Like some of the most incredible animals that seem, it's just like they seem like fantasy creatures and they just aren't, I guess, because they're not cute and cuddly. Right. Like we don't hear about them. And they're also not, they don't kill people generally. So they also don't have the pull of the like, you know, tabloid headlines.
Right.
They're probably ambush predators, so they just move so slowly and quietly. They like look like part of the environment until they're right behind you and it's too late, because they're not very fast. They don't just like cruise around like, you know, you see great whites and other sharks, and they're not like zooming around like a cheetah, but they're fairly fast and active and vicious.
So that's how they get the polar bears, is just sneaking up on them?
Well, I'm not sure exactly. I don't think they've ever been observed hunting polar bears. Most likely, they just suck up these rotting carcasses of polar bears.
Oh, interesting.
So a polar bear dies, falls into the water, and these Greenland sharks just like vacuum this entire dead polar bear.
Wow.
They've also been found in their, and the only reason we know this is like when we catch them and they're dead, and researchers look inside their stomachs and they found rotting horses, moose, seals. They even found an entire reindeer carcass.
Whoa. How'd they get a horse?
See, that's what makes me think that these must have fallen into the ocean somehow.
Yeah, I'm still not clear on how a horse fell in the ocean, but things happen.
It was on a cruise, on a Disney cruise.
There we go. There it is.
Because they do scavenge for food as mm-hmm. well. So they're predators and scavengers.
They kind of remind me of coyotes, everything you're describing about yeah. them. A coyote once almost got my dog by sneaking up.
Yeah, yeah.
She was on a leash. I was walking her.
Yeah.
And a coyote almost
Very
got her.
Very sneaky. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, they're kind of like that, but huge.
Right.
And ancient.
So even more terrifying.
And undying. they're an apex predator, meaning like they don't have any natural predators mm-hmm. except, you know, humans.
Of course.
There is a bit of a cosmic irony here because, like, the Greenland sharks like to eat these, like, dead, rotting animals. Mm-hmm. And we return the favor, at least in Iceland. There's an Icelandic dish, and my apologies for this whole episode. Just accept my apology for the pronunciation things with these food items. So it's called, I think, hakarl, which is made of rotting Greenland shark meat. Mm-hmm. This is a pretty incredible dish. The raw Greenland shark is actually poisonous due to the large amounts of urea and trimethylamine inoxide in their flesh. By fermenting the shark meat, it's rendered edible, I guess? It's not
right.
edible in the strictest sense.
That it won't kill you anymore.
Right. So traditionally, hakarl is made by placing the shark body in a shallow, sandy grave, then burying it in sand and gravel. Then heavy stones are placed on top to put pressure on the shark. Mm-hmm. And also, I guess, to keep the zombie shark from rising, I would assume.
Yeah.
No, that's not actually, like, part of the...
No, but
it
makes sense.
But to me, if I was, like, burying this, like, giant, ancient shark that eats polar bears, I'd definitely be sure to put some heavy rocks on its grave.
Yeah.
And then it's left to ferment for, 12 weeks in the ground. Then it's cut into strips and hung to dry in a meat drying house. It's no longer really made this way for mass consumption in Iceland. It's instead made by squeezing it in a plastic container. But, you know, for sort of more like cultural reasons, sometimes it's still made traditionally, especially like as a thing to show people who are visiting. Mm-hmm. It apparently has an extremely strong ammonia flavor.
No kidding.
Because, you know, like it's even though the fermentation process does make those toxic urea like not as harmful, it's mm-hmm. still like pretty.
Yeah.
I've never had it, so I'm not going to say, oh, this is not a good dish. Mm-hmm. I would say because I've not been acclimated to eating any kind of meat like this, I would probably struggle
yeah.
with it.
Some things really truly are acquired taste.
Yes. I do have the opinions of Anthony Bourdain and Gordon Ramsay here.
Uh-huh.
So Anthony Bourdain said it was the, quote, single worst, most disgusting and terrible tasting thing, which I think is a pretty harsh thing. I don't think he's ever eaten, like when I was in college, I used to make myself macaroni and cheese and then from the box, like the Kraft, uh-huh. and then I'd put it in the fridge, like the little mini fridge, and uh-huh. it'd just sit there and dry out. And then like a day later, I'd be like, huh, I still have some macaroni and cheese left. And it'd be this like mummified mac and cheese, you know, just congealed, that milky, bright orange toxic stuff.
Yeah.
So I feel like that would be the worst thing.
I can see that. No, I would still think that the fermented shark would be worse.
Shark. Yeah. Gordon Ramsay couldn't even like eat it. He tried to eat it and he couldn't.
Yeah, because Anthony Bourdain was much braver than Gordon Ramsay hoped to be.
Such a weenie. Calling you out, Ramsay. So this is something that the Vikings were thought to have eaten mm-hmm. as well. Another weird thing that the Vikings ate, again, not going to pronounce this good, Surir Hutsbrungar.
That sounds right to me.
Yeah, sure. Let's pretend it is.
Yeah.
It soured pickled ram's testicles.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
That actually sounds a little, despite the fact that it's ram's testicles, it sounds a little better to me than the shark.
Right, when you get some pickling brine in there, that can do a lot of work.
Right, because you pickle it, and it, you know, sour, you know, that, like, I've had, like, sour meat, sweet and sour meat, like, that's good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
So, you know, but, of course, I don't want to drag Iceland too much, because they're not, this is not like, oh, man, Iceland's so weird, they make weird dishes.
Well,
this
they is, don't have a lot of produce.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, and also, throughout human history, we've all, like, everyone in every culture, yes. Nobody is immune. We all have made some freaky stuff. So yeah. Here's, and I'm sure this may be some stuff you're familiar with. Here's some of the weirdest stuff that we've eaten throughout human history, at least in Europe.
Uh-huh.
I got some of this research from the Fine Dining Lovers website, the author Peter Basildon. So thank you. This is a truly disturbing thing that I read this article that made me not want to eat ever again. So thank you, Peter. So in medieval Europe, the helmeted cock is a cooked chicken and pig, where the chicken is made to ride the pig while wearing military regalia.
Oh,
here's a picture of it. I'll probably post that or post the link to that in the show notes. But it's
that looks like sort of the late Renaissance period,
yeah,
when people got really weird about food.
Yeah.
They were doing stuff like that to show off constantly.
Yeah. It's a, well, like, what else do you know?
The idea of the turducken is supposed to have come from there, just putting things inside things inside things.
Oh, I've got a good one for that. Another medieval Europe one is the live frog pie. It was a fad to surprise guests by sticking live animals in a pie, empty pie crust, and have them pop out when they cut into it.
Is that a fun surprise?
No.
I wouldn't think so.
I don't think it is. I mean, this is, you know, when is this medieval Europe? Is this like around the Black Death, maybe right after, right before?
Everyone had a really dark sense of humor.
Exactly. So now moving on to the Tudors, which came a little later. I'm not a historian, but so roasted swan, a dish where, and we don't really eat swan that much anymore.
No, we don't.
It's not necessarily the best tasting bird, I don't think. It's also,
it's probably not, and we raise so many chickens, we don't have to bother.
The swan was redressed in its skin and feathers so it looked like it did when it was alive. So it's like this dead swan full of roasted meat, just like with the swan skin.
Mm-hmm.
God, that's so horrible.
It's dark. And when they could get their hands on a peacock, they would do that too.
Yeah, yeah.
It was so much show.
Yeah.
Clearly they didn't care what it tasted like.
There's something so disturbing about that. Like,
yeah.
Like, you know, so if you murder someone, that's pretty bad, right?
Right.
That's upsetting.
Yes.
If you murder someone, skin them and like jumble around their insides and then sew them back up.
Yeah, you'll go to jail for longer if you do that.
Yeah, right? Like the sentencing, mandatory sentencing on jumbling people up and sewing them back up.
Yeah.
There's something disturbing about, like, because then it's like, it's not just about the necessity of eating, it's about mutilating the corpse of the animal you're eating.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, the cockatrice, which is a suckling pig, and a suckling pig is like a baby pig, that's upper body was sewn onto the lower half of a capon, a castrated rooster, which, you know, I mean, like, sure, like, turn your food into a Boschian nightmare. That's fine.
Exactly what they were doing, right?
Right. Like, hey, what, wouldn't it be funny if a pig was sewn to a rooster and we ate it?
Is this British too?
Yes, this is the in Tudor.
So that too. Yeah. Yeah, well, the Tudors were super into showing off, so I guess this is how they did it.
Yes.
And it's weird if they thought it was funny. British people became funny, but clearly weren't at that
Their
time.
Their sense of humor is I don't know.
It was not good then.
Yeah, this researching this episode has made me want to swear off meat entirely forever.
Absolutely.
Like, I'm already, like, trying to cut back on it for health and environmental reasons. Mm-hmm. But, like, I like see this and, like, maybe I'll just eat carrots for the rest of my life.
Yeah. People aren't really sowing carrots to Brussels sprouts or whatever.
No. Although, so the Elizabethans would do bone marrow on toast. And I've actually had this.
Yep.
And it's really good.
It is.
And honestly, like, if, you know, if you're gonna have bones anyway and you don't use them, that's a waste of animal.
Agreed.
So, like, if you use everything, every part of the animal, which I think is probably good practice if you're gonna, you know, have meat, putting bone marrow on toast is pretty tasty.
Yeah, it does taste good. People describe it in a way that either sounds really appetizing or off-putting, depending on your head. It's just meat butter.
It is meat butter. Mm-hmm. It's kind of gelatinous, which sounds gross, but it's like, and I'm very sensitive to texture and stuff, and I can actually down this pretty well. I have to spread it thin though. I don't like it too chunky.
Yeah, but then when it's thin, it melts just a teeny bit into the bread, and
it's pretty nice.
It does taste really good.
Yeah, yeah. So the Georgians did, and this is kind of what you were talking about, like the turducken. It was the roti sans peril. Again, apologies for the French there. It's a French dish of 17 birds stuffed inside each other. So according to an article in Vice, the recipe calls for a bustard stuffed with a turkey, stuffed with a goose, stuffed with a pheasant, stuffed with a chicken, stuffed with a duck, stuffed with a guinea fowl, stuffed with a teal, stuffed with a woodcock, stuffed with a partridge, stuffed with a plover, stuffed with a lapwing, stuffed with a quail, stuffed with a thrush, stuffed with a lark, stuffed with an ortolan, bunting, stuffed with a garden warbler, stuffed with an olive, stuffed with an anchovy, stuffed with a single caper. Guys.
Yeah.
Stop it.
That, first of all, that would be so frustrating to cook because it would take days and then it's gone in a minute.
Yeah. I mean, and it's also, they cook at different rates. It's a nightmare.
Yeah. That's so wasteful.
Yeah. I mean, like what? Like 17 different, more than 17 animals had to die to make that because they also like used like pig fat and all these other things and on a bed of child bones. I don't know.
And there's no possible way, I'm going to say this without ever having it, that it tasted very good.
No, I imagine it wouldn't. Because you can't. There's no way.
It's just too much together. Like, there's too much happening.
No. It's just complete insanity.
Yes.
It's. I feel like we have this concept that serial killers only happen within modern society. I think they've always been around. It's just back in these times, they were endorsed. Their behavior was considered good and normal, and they got to be chefs, and they got to be kings and queens.
Wow.
And they just got away, or like, I'm going to sew a pig to a duck and then stuff it inside an ostrich, and everyone's like, how droll. Yes, please.
Wow, I like that theory. Mm-hmm. That's cool, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Monsters.
Well, they were.
Monsters.
Yeah. So now we know.
Yeah. Humans are clearly ridiculous omnivores, but in modern times, our diets can range from omnivorous, vegetarian, and vegan. But what about 100% carnivorous? Well, maybe, but you'd have to eat your meat completely raw. Around the turn of the century, Icelandic explorer Vilhelmur Stefansson traveled to Alaska, where the Inuit of the Mackenzie Delta allowed him to live with them, and they taught him about their lifestyle. Stefansson became an advocate of their diet, which was 90% meat and fish for 6 to 9 months of the year, an extreme ketogenic diet. But before you try it yourself, you should know that it would be difficult to replicate. They ate freshly hunted, sometimes raw meat, and caught fresh fish, which they also on occasion ate raw. And only by eating raw liver, fish roe, and eggs can you get the vitamin C you need to avoid scurvy. And if you try to eat only meat and do it incorrectly, you can die of malnutrition. Rabbit starvation is a form of starvation caused by eating primarily rabbit meat, which in more scientific terms is called protein poisoning. It's when there's not enough fat in the diet, so you will starve even if you continue eating. As Stefansson explained, quote, "Rabbit eaters, if they have no fat from another source, beaver, moose, fish, will develop diarrhea in about a week with headache, lassitude, and vague discomfort. If there are enough rabbits, the people eat till their stomachs are distended, but no matter how much they eat, they feel unsatisfied." So don't go trying a meat-only diet at home, especially if all you've got to eat are some wascally wabbits. Hey, drop that fork! We'll be right back after a quick break. What's food without a little seasoning? And the best seasoning in the world is salt. It's the magical mineral that makes food taste good. So why do we like salt? Well, we do need it to live. You can actually have too little salt in your system, which is a condition known as hypernatremia, which can cause brain swelling and even death. Fortunately, you don't really need to worry about this. Typically, we have too much salt in the diet, but for many animals, salt is so vital, they'll go to some interesting lengths to get it. What I want to talk about is butterflies and bees who love salt,
mm-hmm.
and they will drink tears to get it.
Oh, how do they get the tears?
Well, it depends. So they will sometimes drink turtle tears in the Peruvian Amazon. So
I just got so sad.
So in the Peruvian Amazon, butterflies drink turtle tears to supplement their diet with sodium. Butterflies need sodium, like most living animals, but they can't get it from flowers, so they'll get it typically from dirt or poop, mm-hmm. where you normally get salt.
Of course.
They can also get it from tears, and what better than a turtle that can't retract its head, like the yellow spotted side neck turtles.
Wow.
Who, their heads are just stuck out there. They can't hide in their little shell home.
Uh-huh.
So the butterflies are free to sip at their tears. Here's a picture. And I do want to be clear that the turtle's not sad.
Yeah, can you tell me what would cause a turtle to cry?
I mean, probably it's just the normal amount of tears in their eyes.
So I feel much better.
Irritation, dryness. Yeah, it's not crying because it's sad. Same thing with crocodiles. So butterflies are sometimes seen drinking the tears of crocodiles, like the caiman in Costa Rica. Here's a bee and a butterfly drinking out of the crocodile's tears at the same time.
That's amazing. I feel like I've seen pictures of this before and didn't even think that it might be a thing.
Yeah. So there are also tear-drinking moths in the Amazon jungle that drink bird tears. And sometimes it's not even clear why they do this, because there's like salt in their environment already. So they just like to poke birds in the eyes and make them cry and drink their tears.
Oh, so they're just like little stinkers.
Yeah, they're little stinkers. And here's a picture of one just like sitting on top of a terrified looking bird's head.
Yeah, that seems so rude.
It's very rude. Humans are ruder. We're worse.
Oh, of course.
For those birds out there listening, listeners sensitive to matters of birds, I'm going to warn you about this next one because it's very sad. The Ortolan bunting. Have you heard of this mm-hmm. dish? It's an upsetting. It's an upsetting restaurant or recipe.
Yeah.
So Ortolan bunting is a small, peaceful songbird that is apparently good tasting to some people after being brutally tortured. So in classic Middle French cuisine, the ortolan is placed in a darkened cage, which causes it to become psychologically disturbed, where it feeds compulsively. So in the wild, ortolans will gorge themselves at night. So mm-hmm. if you make it eternal night, they will just keep eating and eating, which is really disturbing.
Yes, it is.
In Roman times, emperors would stab out the eyes of the ortolans so they would compulsively eat even more because like no light can enter their eyes.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know that part.
Yep, it's pretty, I mean, I don't know if that's true. That could be apocryphal, but I wouldn't put it past Romans.
Romans were wild.
Yeah. Caligula, he was a stinker. So the bird is then drowned in brandy so that it is marinated and murdered at the same time.
Wow.
And then it is roasted and eaten whole. Traditionally, people would wear a large handkerchief over their heads to, quote, like, hide from God.
That's right.
It could also have been that sort of like the superstition around it, but it's also could be to trap the odors from the dish.
Okay.
Or to, if it's like, because these would be very wealthy people, it could also be to hide the fact that they're spitting out bird bones as they
okay.
eat. So that's a, I think it's illegal now. It is illegal.
Yeah, but there's TV shows that will depict it as depictions of how wealthy people are.
Right,
they've done it both on Billions and Succession.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wonder if there's any truth to that, like if wealthy people like have black market ortolan
there probably
under the
is.
Table.
Rich people love having everything.
There is a vegan version of ortolan. So these vegan chefs have created a ortolan bunting that's supposed to mimic the taste and texture of a bird with bones in it, made out of entirely vegan ingredients. It doesn't necessarily look exactly like a bird. It looks like one vaguely bird-shaped lump of weird ingredients. But they've put like other things to make it like they wanted to mimic the texture of like skin, guts, and bones. And it's the thing is, one of the benefits, and I'm not vegan, mm-hmm. but one of the benefits I perceive of being vegan is you don't have the gross out factor of eating another living creature.
I know.
So why would you want to replicate it?
Yeah. I don't understand fake meat replicating.
Obviously, it's better. Obviously, it's better than torturing real bird, but
why? Right, yeah. Why would you even want to have the pretend version?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
A little bit of a less macabre, weird preparation of meat is there's a farmer in Seattle that feeds his pigs marijuana.
Oh, cool.
And so it's actually not as crazy and weird as it sounds.
Okay.
It's marijuana that is not used in medical marijuana manufacturing. So instead of throwing out like the stalks and stuff, mm-hmm. he takes it and like incorporates it into the pig slop. Apparently that helps introduce fiber. It actually increases their appetite a little more, like naturally without using like hormones and such. It apparently affects the taste of the meat.
Really?
Makes the meat tastes like more savory or something.
Huh.
I'm not into it that much in terms of like, you know, I feel bad about eating pigs because they look like little doggies to me.
Yeah, true.
But I feel like the least we can do is give them marijuana.
That's such a good point.
Yes. The least we could do is to get them baked before they get baked.
Yeah. Pre-baking.
Pre-baking. I mean, and it is interesting. He claims that the pigs don't necessarily get high, but he does say that they seem to enjoy it a good amount. So I wonder.
Yeah, there's just
how
like,
do you know?
We would never know.
Right.
Yeah. There's got to be like just trace amounts of probably THC and CBD.
Yeah, he says that you can't get high from the meat.
Mm-hmm.
But
they're consuming trace amounts,
right,
maybe.
Right. So they've got to be. There's got to be some high pigs there. You cannot tell me that they're not going to get.
Or at least super chill.
Right, right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Man, I kind of, it's like, it's such a cute story until you're like, oh, and then they're slaughtered. here's a less dark story about seasoning food.
Mm-hmm.
Japanese macaques, which are also known as snow monkeys, will wash their yams and potatoes in salt water.
Aww.
This is exclusive to the Japanese island of Koshima. There's a colony of macaques who have learned how to salt their potatoes.
Oh my gosh.
In 1953, a field macaque named Emo, which is potato in Japanese, was observed by researchers washing sand off of the sweet potato in the river. Her family watched this and they copied her and they learned from her. And then, because normally, like if you got a sandy potato, they would just brush it off with their little, mm-hmm. their little hands. But washing in the river was much more effective. And then Emo put a new spin on it where she took it to the ocean, not the freshwater river, uh-huh. but the ocean, started washing it there. And she found that she preferred that to the river because of the saltiness. She would even like dip it, take a bite, dip it again.
Emo.
So she was double dipping.
I love it.
And her cohorts, her family, uh-huh. Also copied that and started doing the same behavior. Now, even though, I mean, sadly, Emo and all the other original potato dippers have passed away, but this was in 1953, mm-hmm. so they lived nice long lives of potato dipping.
Yeah.
But the macaques living on Koshima Island still practice potato dipping and washing.
Oh my gosh. She changed the game for them.
Yeah. And it's one of the examples that points to like, hey, you know, animals actually can have culture. Like mm-hmm. they can learn, especially the more intelligent animals like primates can learn certain elements of culture and pass things on and pass traditions on.
Yeah.
Which is really incredible.
Yeah. I'm getting more and more freaked out by the idea of keeping primates in zoos.
Yeah.
I feel like they're real similar to us.
Yeah. I mean, some zoos, you know, like there's a lot of conservation going
yes.
on. So I feel like, especially like the San Diego Zoo, I know they go to great lengths to try to create these enclosures that are humane
mm-hmm.
and they go towards a lot of conservation efforts.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm definitely not comfortable with captive primates kept in suboptimal conditions.
Right. Yeah.
It's they're very intelligent. And speaking of which, red colobus monkeys who live in human forests of Western, Central, and Eastern Africa use charcoal to neutralize toxins in their diet.
Oh my gosh.
These are boss bays. But they're living, they're like, instead of doing like, you know, haven't you seen those like eat more charcoal to detoxify your system, which mm-hmm. I don't know about that, but it works for these red colobus monkeys. So they love eating mango and Indian almond tree leaves because they're high in protein. Unfortunately, these leaves are also high in phenols, which upset their little tummies.
Aww.
They've learned to eat charcoal to detoxify the leaves, and it's highly sought after. Like, they'll fight over the charcoal. They'll gather huge amounts of it and carry it and, like, hoard it so they can eat their favorite leaves.
Wow.
So they gather it mostly from burnt trees, but they'll even steal charcoal briquettes from humans when they have
Good.
The chance. Take that. They'll eat the leaves and then eat the charcoal, and they've just discovered that that helps settle their stomachs.
Wow. Do we know if the leaves taste like the fruit?
You mean like mango?
Yeah.
I have no idea. Mm. I don't know. I know that almonds have cyanide in them, so mm-hmm. it's possible the leaves also have some cyanide,
oh, yeah.
which is also a way that the charcoal could help mm-hmm. help their tummies. Because, you know, I mean, if you consume small amounts of cyanide, you won't die, but
right.
it'll definitely make you sick.
Mm-hmm.
But don't do it. Like, don't. I'm not going to, you know, don't be like, oh, well, if I have a little bit, it's okay. Like, any amount, not bad news. And speaking of neutralizing toxins, birds will eat dirt to do this.
Okay. Does it have to be any kind of dirt?
It's a specific kind of dirt. So eating dirt is called geophagia. Lots of animals eat dirt, birds, bats, and primates. This is often done to introduce minerals into their diet, such as calcium, sodium, iron, zinc, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes pregnant women will crave dirt, which could be out of a desire to make up for mineral deficiency like anemia, or potentially because certain types of clay or dirt could help destroy pathogens in the gut.
Oh.
I don't recommend eating dirt
mm-hmm.
Because you could just as easily introduce harmful pathogens and toxins. Like, there's helminth parasitic worms whose eggs can survive in dirt for years. And you can also get lead from eating just random dirt.
Yikes. But when you're pregnant, things go crazy, right? I've heard read case studies of pregnant women actually buying salt licks, like you would keep in a barn to consume on their own.
Yeah. And like pica is the term for eating things that are typically inedible.
Mm-hmm.
And so pregnant women will often have that because it's like their body is craving something. And so they will eat things that aren't necessarily have any, like eating ice is another one. Although I do that and I'm not pregnant, so I don't know what's up with that.
Huh.
But for the Peruvian Amazon rainforest parrots, dirt is a way to filter toxins out of their diet, and they're super, super picky about what dirt specifically they eat. So they will flock to this one specific place near the Manu River and only one layer of soil along the bend. So you know how soil is in these sedimentary mm-hmm. layers. They pick this one band of soil. And the reason they do this soil layer has the highest cation exchange capacity. So this is some chemistry stuff. It's a little unfamiliar for me, so bear with me. So cations are positively charged ions. Most soil is negatively charged. So they will stick together, negative, positive. If soil has high cation exchange capacity, it can attract to and bind to more cations. So the parrots eat seeds and unripe fruit that has alkaloids and toxins that are harmful, and these toxins will become positively charged inside the parrot's acidic stomach, some kind of chemical reaction there. And so if the clay that they eat has a high cation exchange capacity, it will bind to these now positively charged toxins. So the clay is negatively charged. The toxins are positively charged in their stomachs. They'll bind together, and that neutralizes the toxins. And then it allows the parrots to eat these foods that they love without getting sick.
Those are some fancy parrots.
They really are. And it's funny to see them because they're all just kind of lined along this one band of this, like, dirt, this face of dirt along the river. Just all like diners.
Yeah, they know exactly what they want.
So because we are talking about eating dirt, I got a little surprise for you.
Oh, boy.
It is dirt soda. It says it's shoveled and bottled in the USA. I don't know. Now, the ingredients don't mention dirt. So the ingredients is carbonated artesian spring water, cane sugar, citric acid, artificial flavor, caramel color, ester gum, flash patch pasteurized as a natural preservative. So nowhere do they say it contains dirt.
I'm sure that's the natural flavor is whatever essence they...
Right. Like, is it dirt essence?
Probably.
I don't know if it's supposed to taste like dirt, if it's just, like, that they didn't clean the factories. So if you would mind, we're going to do a little taste test here.
I'm down for it.
Hang on. Oh, wait. I hope this is a twist off. It might not be, actually. I'm going to go get a bottle opener. I'll probably cut out some of that of us struggling to open this bottle of dirt soda. Much anticipated dirt soda.
I know. I hope it was worth the struggle.
I mean, it's got to be. Such a big buildup.
So it's kind of red.
Yeah, it's got a nice amber color.
Mm-hmm.
So that's for you.
Thank you.
This is for me.
A toast to dirt soda.
Cheers. Yeah.
I only felt the dirt at the very beginning. You know what it reminds me of?
It's got a dirt bouquet.
Yeah. But it's kind of cream soda-y.
A little bit, yeah.
Ooh, I don't care for the aftertaste.
No. So it's like the taste on the tongue is actually no dirt. But it's very dirt forward. And it's like a dirt aftertaste.
It's, yeah. I wouldn't say that it really approximates dirt. It's just a little gross.
Yeah, it's kind of just nasty. I used to eat some dirt when I was a kid.
Uh-huh.
Like, especially love, you know those like little Fertlitz white fertilizer pellets?
Oh my gosh.
Those were fun to crunch on.
Are those good?
No. Well, not healthy for you. They're bad to eat, but they were. I enjoyed it.
Were you not allowed to eat junk food? Was it like your Cheeto substitute?
Yeah, I my parents were very good at having us eat healthy. I could eat like Goldfish crackers and stuff, but
that was a treat for you.
Yeah, but you know, I would eat raw snails when I was a baby.
Mm-hmm.
I would eat dirt.
Did you? So you were a baby. Yeah. You didn't have a sense that you were eating a live animal.
No, I had no. I have no memory of it. My mom just tells me that.
Got it.
So. I do remember eating ants, and those were actually pretty good. They're kind of peppery tasting.
Right, yeah.
Not bad. This kind of almost smells like crayons.
I can see that.
Like dirty crayons.
Yeah.
Dirty crayons that like a smoker. It's like, smells like you're in a smoker's car that's full of dirt, crayons, and sugar.
So there's this... setup that people who are training to learn about wine can use,
mm-hmm.
where it's a set of like 80 different essences. And so mm-hmm. you learn how to identify the essences so you can describe the wine. And 72 of those essences are delicious things.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the 8 that are gross that can help you describe like a corked bottle of wine. And this dirt soda is actually kind of reminding me of the Band-Aid essence.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
There's a Band-Aid essence mm-hmm. with like... Well, so are these essences that help you identify bad wine or
good and bad? So most of them are for identifying good wine.
I see.
And then there's a couple that you're like, oh no, something's gone wrong.
Somebody dropped a Band-Aid in the wine.
It's something like if it's oxidized or something like that. But that's what this, I feel like they dropped essence of Band-Aid into this.
God, it's not good.
No.
It's not even good to drink ironically.
No.
The smell alone is very bad. Because like honestly, dirt... Like, the smell of wet dirt, like petrichor, is actually really nice.
Yeah, it is.
It doesn't... This smells like duty.
Yeah, I feel like dirt is maybe something that you can't synthesize or make synthetic, I should
say.
Right. This is just gross.
This is just gross.
In a way that, like you said, I don't think dirt is actually as gross.
So, if you're going to give the dirt soda rating, Can we get a rating there out of, like, let's do 5 stars?
Half a star.
Mm-hmm.
Just out of interest.
I'll give it 2 stars.
Oh, wow.
Just because of how difficult the bottle was to open, which I felt like was kind of a nice, it's like almost aposematism, like where it's like a warning sign that you shouldn't drink it. So for that design of it to be hard to open, I think 2 stars.
I like that. Yeah.
Why do humans use spices? Just because it tastes good? Well, researchers tried to answer this question. A scientific paper called Darwinian Gastronomy, Why We Use Spices by Sherman et al. Found that spice use may be used potentially to protect us from microorganisms and food poisoning by borrowing the defensive weapons of plants from which spices are derived. But when we return, we'll find that there may be no spice antidote to certain dangerous diets. Sometimes we go to great lengths for our meals, even putting ourselves in danger. The Heart Attack Grill in Las Vegas, which offers the octuple bypass hamburger, should give you an idea of how much we're willing to risk for our food. We're also willing to eat fugu fish, a type of puffer fish which, if prepared improperly, can be deadly, as it contains lethal amounts of tetrodotoxin in its inner organs. Both humans and dolphins risk death by eating wriggling octopus. Sanakji, a Korean dish, is made of freshly killed octopus. Some people think that they're still alive, as nerve activity continues to function within the tentacles, causing them to wriggle around. This presents a choking hazard. If not chewed properly, the suction cups can stick to your throat and actually kill you. Dolphins also risk being choked to death when eating octopus, and sometimes smash the octopus by tossing it around, tearing it to shreds to make it less dangerous. But sometimes you're not even out of the woods if you swallow your dinner. Casu marzu is a classic Sardinian dish made of sheep milk cheese and live larvae of the cheese fly. This is meant to give the cheese a nice soft texture, but if the larvae survive the trip down your gullet, the worms can try to burrow through and eat your stomach lining, resulting in a condition called pseudomyasis, aka accidental parasitization. The common Asian toad has also suffered from indigestion. The blind snake, a small worm-like snake, can survive being ingested and has been seen escaping alive out of the butt of a common Asian toad.
Well, you just described all my worst nightmares. That's all horrifying.
That's what the podcast's about. It's bringing nightmares to the surface so you can, you know, not have them when you're sleeping, but when you're awake.
Yeah, thank you so much.
You're welcome. I remember learning about Casu marzu in like an anthropology class, mm-hmm. where we were talking about, like, I think it's good to eat insects generally as part of our cuisine, and I haven't been socialized myself to eat insects, but I think it's a great protein source.
Yes.
In this case, this is different.
I don't know. For people who haven't eaten insects, it's not that weird.
Right.
And it's mostly crunchy.
Right. It's like eating popcorn, but legs.
Yeah. Yeah. But this cheese maggot thing is...
You can see them. They're still alive.
Yes.
They like jump out of the cheese sometimes.
I don't understand how this dish came about.
Accident, I would assume.
Yeah, but why keep doing it? Like, why is it considered?
Because they liked it. Because it probably tastes good.
Really?
If you can get over it, yeah.
All right.
I don't know.
I'll never know. I'm not going to try it.
Well, no. I mean, I will try most insects, mm-hmm. except for live insects, I think.
I think that's
especially
really fair.
Mixed with cheese. That almost makes it worse.
It totally does.
Yeah. Humans will sometimes, as we already discussed, will imperil themselves for food. And one really amazing example of this is honey hunters of Nepal. So there is a man named Mali Dhan, who is one of the last mad honey hunters of Nepal. And now he's not mad, but the honey is called mad honey.
Okay.
He's part of the Kulung indigenous people, and they have been using this mad honey for centuries because it has medicinal properties. It's mm-hmm. an antiseptic. It can be like a cough syrup, and honey has like this antibiotic property and can actually help heal your throat. But to get this, he will climb a 300-foot bamboo rope ladder up a sheer cliff face of granite above the Hongu River. So he's after the red honey produced by Himalayan bees, which is called mad honey because it has psychotropic properties. It becomes psychotropic because bees feed on the flowers of rhododendron trees, which contain toxins.
Okay.
It can also be sold on the black market for like $80 a pound.
Oh.
Because it's like you get high off of honey.
Yeah. It sounds fun.
Yeah, it does sound fun. It doesn't sound fun to collect, though.
No.
So he has to hold on to the cliff face by hand with tiny footholds while carrying a huge bamboo pole that he uses to saw off sections of the honeycomb while he carries some burning grass to kind of try to soothe the bees, which are not happy and they still sting him. But if he flinches, like, he could fall to his death.
Is he doing this for the potential money?
It's partially that. So it's partially just for survival, you know, to get the money. It's also... sort of part of this tradition, and there's a deep spiritualness to it.
Oh, okay.
So it's a very meaningful thing. So it makes sense that he's not just doing it to try to get high off the honey.
Right.
It is of great cultural significance, and it's very helpful for him and his family because of the money. Especially when it's harder to get other sources of income.
Right.
It's just incredible. And, I mean, he does have a helper, like, on the other side of the cliff.
Okay.
But from that side of the cliff, you can't reach the honeycomb. Or if you try to get it, like, you could make the whole honeycomb fall down. And they don't want that. Like,
wow.
They really don't. And they do it in a way where they don't want to harm the bees. Mm-hmm. They don't want to, like, you know, destroy the colony. So
right.
It's very conscientious. They sing this song, like, as they're doing it, about, like, you know, I'm not here to hurt you. I'm like,
oh,
you know,
wow.
It's the honey kind of looks, it looks a little bit like this, the color of this dirt soda, although not the viscosity.
Well, this dirt soda is actually really pretty. The color of it is garnet.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's very pretty to look at, not good to eat. The honey is probably really nice to eat.
Yeah.
And then very fun.
Right.
With psychotropic properties. So bees themselves can also be daredevils when it comes to getting a meal. They will get punched in the face by flowers.
Oh, okay.
Punched in the face by flowers. So alfalfa leaf cutting bees are found all over the world, but they were introduced to the U.S., so they're not indigenous.
Mm-hmm.
And they were introduced to help with crops. They're solitary bees, so meaning they don't form colonies or store honey in honeycombs. They'll build their own individual nests and line them with the leaves that they've cut.
Oh.
So even though they're not social bees, they're fine with each other. They're not, like, aggressive. So
they just live in studio apartments.
Exactly. In fact, farmers will sometimes make high-rise apartments for them out of styrofoam.
Oh my gosh.
So they'll cut out little holes in styrofoam to house, like hundreds of these bees. And they're just each in their little apartment, and they know where to go, where their babies are. They need them for alfalfa, and alfalfa is a major component in feeding cows and other livestock.
Mm-hmm.
Alfalfa flowers are really hard to pollinate. Their pollen is deep inside the flower, and it's only released when the bee steps on what's called a keel petal, which is a spring-loaded petal that actually ejects pollen from the flower. So they step on the petal, and then this pollen column, like, shoots out of the flower.
Oh, wow.
and shoots out pollen. And this is normally a good strategy for the alfalfa, because it launches the pollen onto the pollinator and gets it all over. And it's a very effective way of distributing pollen and also avoiding, like, self-pollination. But alfalfa is also introduced to the U.S. So the western bees, the honeybees found here, are really ginger, and they're kind of weenies.
Yeah.
They don't really want to be punched by a flower. So they've figured out how to, like, very carefully step around the keel petal.
Oh my gosh.
So they don't get punched, and then they sip honey from, or the they sip the nectar, like, from the side of the flower. But leafcutter bees are some bad bitches.
Right.
Who, they are really tough enough to take a flower punch to the face. And they'll just, like, you can see videos of it. I'll post a link where the bees just, like, get in, and they, like, it punched in the face with pollen, they just continue on.
So there's no indication that it like startles them. They don't kind of go fly about.
No, okay. they seem totally cool with it. They kind of look a little more tankish. They're like sort of gray and black, mm-hmm. and they look a little more bulky, a little more sort of like these pro wrestler bees. Like glow bees.
Yes. I love that.
Because these are going to be females for the most part. Mm-hmm. I just love that. If these bees weren't able to take a punch to the face from a flower, like we probably wouldn't be able to have as much crop pollination of alfalfa in the U.S. So it really does transform our whole farming industry.
That's the kind of thing that people need to know about so that they can be actually concerned about bees dying off.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Like if you, these bees aren't willing to get punched in the face, we will not have milk.
Yeah. Yes.
And totally. Ice cream.
Yeah.
Bees getting punched in the face equals having cheese.
Ice cream.
Yeah, and ice cream. Yeah.
We have to say ice cream because it has to be the thing people most want,
right? Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So I want to end the show with a listener question. So Brittany asks, tapirs are my favorite animals, specifically Malayan tapirs. Tapirs. When I was at the zoo recently, there was a tapir talk. The keeper told us that tapirs are known to climb trees, but I can't find any information on this at all. Also, tapirs could be on an episode for Cutest Babies. Unfortunately, we're not. So I actually didn't know whether this is true or not, although it seems improbable because tapirs, they're large pig-shaped animals. Mm-hmm. They have these long snouts, which are actually a tiny prehensile trunk.
Oh.
They're found in the jungles and forests of South and Central America and Southeast Asia. They're actually not related to pigs as much as they are odd-toed ungulates. So they're related to zebras, rhinos, horses, and donkeys. They're about 6 feet long, 300 to 700 pounds. Ooh. They live up to 25 to 30 years. They're herbivores. And as for being able to climb trees, I don't think they can climb trees like you would imagine like a monkey or a little bear or a jaguar climbing up a tree, like clambering up and like sitting on top of the tree and mm-hmm. being like, what now? but they are surprisingly athletic and agile. So they can kind of march their legs up the tree and then stand on their hind legs to reach the tallest leaves. So here's a picture of that.
Oh.
And then they can get those really high up leaves. They can also swim really well, so they'll climb, and they can climb steep mountains. So
they're just athletes.
They're athletes, yeah. So they are surprisingly agile on like these really steep mountains, like goats, mm-hmm. basically. So their diet is fruit, berries, and seeds, and their dung actually is really good for saving the rainforest. So it contains a lot of undamaged seeds that can help replant the Amazon rainforest, especially because they like to go into parts of the rainforest that have been recently disturbed mm-hmm. Or deforested or burned, where new growth is starting to come back because they like those like new tender leaves. They poop there and they distribute a lot of the seeds, and then that can help the biodiversity of the rainforest.
They just sound like all-around great guys.
And they're adorable. They're adorable, especially the babies, as the listener suggested. So they will also sometimes push less sturdy trees over, like as they're sort of like rising up on their hind legs and putting their little forelegs on the tree, they will push it over. And mm-hmm. that's actually, even though it sounds destructive, it's actually very important for other species, because by lowering the leaves, it allows other species of animals to access them. So this helps the sambar deer, the barking deer, and chevrotains, which I'm so excited to talk about these because, so on the show we've talked about dik-diks, which are adorable little tiny antelopes. Mm-hmm. Watch out, dik-diks. These chevrotains are even tinier.
Oh my gosh.
These are the smallest hooved animals in the world. They're also known as the mouse deer. Look at this little guy. They're teeny tiny.
I'm going to freak out.
They're like a little bigger than a chihuahua.
Oh my gosh.
They're so tiny. I know everyone's been giving me dik-dik pic-pics, which has been great. But can we start the chevrotain train now? Because I want pictures of chevrotains because they are so cute. I'll include a link to some photos of these guys. They're adorable. And so that makes it's just so cute that like these big tapirs, it's like they lower the, because otherwise these little guys couldn't reach these trees.
Tapirs sound amazing. They're my favorite animal now.
Yeah, they. I want there to be a Disney movie about a tapir and a chevrotain that team up and like little guy, maybe he has some special skills where he can help like the tapir, and the tapir like lowers trees for him, like sort of a Milo and Otis situation.
This is good.
Get on that, Disney.
Yeah. Well, you need to get credit for it.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Pay me the big bucks for my chevrotain tapir story called like chevrotain train and tapir capers.
We'll still workshop that.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. And thank you for trying the dirt soda.
My pleasure.
Do you got anything to plug?
Just my podcast. I even know how to pronounce it. My podcast, which is Smart Mouth, which is two words, which apparently some people...
Smart Mouth.
Yeah, Smart Mouth, two words. I'm starting a newsletter at smartmouth.substack.com, and it has an Instagram at Smart Mouth Podcast.
Awesome.
Yeah.
You can find us on the internet, creaturefeaturepod.com, creaturefeaturepod on Instagram, creaturefeatpod on Twitter, F-E-A-T, not F-E-E-T, that is very different. You can find me at Katie Golden, and of course, as always, at Pro Bird Rights, where I really fight for the important things in life, like bread access for birds. Don't actually feed birds bread, it's dangerous.
It is the best Twitter account, though.
Thank you. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you're liking the podcast, please mash that subscribe. What is it on podcast? Rate it, subscribe it, like it.
Yeah, we'll do all those things.
Press the stars.
Yeah, yeah.
Please do that. And you can catch us next Wednesday.
Yay.
Thank you. Creature Feature is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. And thanks to the Space Cossacks for their awesome song, Exolumina.